This is Dylan FM, the podcast that goes deep into the work and world of Bob Dylan. You're listening to an extended episode, available exclusively to FM Plus or premium subscribers, with your host, Craig Danieloff.
Bob Dylan has been a solo performer relatively rarely over his long and active career, and very rarely if you skip over the first few years. Since 1965, he's played with well over 100 musicians on stage in a parade of nearly constant change. There's a webpage called Bob Dylan's Gigging Bands that lists all the names of who's played on stage with Bob Dylan. It's fascinating and fun. There's a link to it in the show notes. What does one learn when playing on stage with Bob Dylan? What can they tell us about the music and the arrangements and the performances? What can those people tell us about Bob Dylan? Imagine the stories these people could tell. Well, in large part, we don't have to imagine anymore because Ray Padgett has been talking to them. For over 2 years, in a project that began for his excellent Flagging Down the Double E's newsletter and Substack, Ray has been interviewing people who played with Bob or were somehow involved in the process of putting on Dylan's live shows. He spoke to nearly 50 of them, and he assembled all of these interviews into a new book called Pledging My Time, Conversation with Bob Dylan's Band Members. And not surprisingly, it's full of great stories and interesting answers to Ray's intelligent questioning. Ray's got a deep knowledge of Dylan, the shows, the tours, and the events that these people were involved with, and it propels the conversation forward. He seems to always know what to ask and to show them he's there for the details. The book is out now in paperback, hardback, and ebook. You'll definitely want to grab a copy. There are links in the show notes to help you do so. Who did he talk to? Here are some of the names: Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Jim Keltner, Scarlett Rivera, Rob Stoner, Regina McCrary, Larry Campbell, Duke Robillard, Winston Watson, Freddie Coella, Michael Soinbaum Portney, Benmont Tench, and many, many more. Ray and I spoke last week just after Pledging My Time's official release. I'd had just a few days with the book, but was already full of questions. Ray, as you'll hear, was ready to answer and shared tons of great stories from the book and his conversations. We've even interwoven some of the audio clips from his original interviews in today's show, so you'll get to hear some of these stories in the musicians' own voices. Ray has been a guest here on Dylan FM a few times, sharing his knowledge of cover songs primarily, and he's soon to be the host of a new podcast on that subject for our FM podcast network. It's another great reason to become a subscriber to FM Plus if you're not yet. Visit fmpods.com to learn more. There is, as usual, a longer version of this conversation for FM Plus subscribers and our premium members, and a video version for our premium members as well. There are details about subscribing or joining in the show notes, but if you're in Apple Podcasts, you can subscribe directly in the app. Now, let's hear our discussion with Ray Padgett about his new book, Pledging My Time, Conversations with Bob Dylan's Band Members. All right, welcome, Ray Padgett. Thanks for joining us again to talk about your new, now number one best-selling, at least in your category on Amazon, book, which is called Pledging My Time.
Thanks for having me back. And yeah, the in your category is an important caveat. Music history books, not quite at the, you know, not going to be the next Harry Potter.
Well, it's great. And everyone's talking about it and everyone's starting to, you know, have copies have dribbled out over the last couple of weeks and people are excited. And it's a great book. As I told you, I'm about 2/3 the way through and I got pages of lots of yellow marks and pages of notes for us to talk about today. So great accomplishment. I'm looking forward to talking to you more about it today.
I appreciate it.
Why don't you just tell us a little bit of how this came to be? Meaning what I wanted to know was this a kind of a lightning strike that you said, hey, nobody has talked to all these people and pulled it together? Or did you have one conversation and it kind of turned into another and slowly the idea emerged? Because at the end, what is unique about this is no one's done it before and that makes it very compelling for all of us who care about such things.
It was definitely closer to the second scenario. You know, I started doing them for my newsletter. And at first I figured I wouldn't be able to do any because like people would have signed NDAs. As you say, many of these people have never really spoken before, or at least, you know, not beyond a platitude or two occasionally. And it was, you know, it was fairly hard to get, especially the first few. It's hard to get all, especially the first few of the newsletter. But then, you know, I got a couple and then one led to another and people introduced me to other people. And so, yeah, maybe when I had done, I don't know, 10 or 15 sort of substantive interviews that had run the newsletter, that's when I started thinking, you know, there could be a book here if I get 40 or 50 of these together. And so I just kept doing them for the newsletter, but also at the same time, I sort of kept doing ones that I was just sort of secreting away for the book, you know, where I had sort of pitched them on this book. So there are a couple of these, Ramblin' Jack, I think I talked to like 2.5 years ago and I just kind of sat on it. So it's been in the works for a while, but it wasn't really a flash of lightning, mostly because I didn't assume I could get this many.
As I've read it, I've tried to kind of think about the bigger picture because you can get lost in all the stories and all the, you know, tidbits that come out. And it seems to me it's interesting for a whole bunch of reasons. One is, as you say, there's this assumption, and I do think it turns out to be assumption or this unstated bond of silence that the Dylan world has, or we've always heard or assumed. Number two is a lot of Bob stuff, you know, this kind of proximity issue. It seems like nobody gets close to him. And if they do, it's for a fleeting period of time. And which all leads to this, the fact we're also interested in this, which is 60 plus years of public life on, he's still generally a mystery. Kind of, I feel like there's this puzzle we're all trying to solve. And you've brought a whole bunch of other pieces to it. When you talk to them, was there anything you wanted to unlock, or what were the goals in each interview that you were seeking to do in the cumulative whole of the book?
There was a lot I wanted to unlock. I mean, a lot of it is maybe first and foremost was what's the experience of playing music with this guy like? I mean, you know, we see what we see from the audience and as fans, but how do these new arrangements come about? How do they, you know, when they're changing songs every night, how does that happen when they're not changing songs, but the arrangements are shifting every night? How does that happen? So there's that sort of nuts and bolts musicianship stuff, one. And then two is like, what is it like off stage? You know, you hear rumors of like, can't even look Bob in the eye or you'll get in trouble, you know, that sort of thing, which turns out mostly not to be true. You know, most of these people had fairly good relationships with him off stage, some very personal and friendly, and they have all these amazing anecdotes of hanging out, some more professional, and they had a nice time, but they didn't, you know, chill on the bus too much in the off hours. But just, you know, that's the sort of thing that we have so little window into and that so few people have talked about. I was just really curious about like, what is it literally like when you're on the road for 9 months a year for 4 or 5 years with this guy who's fairly inscrutable? What is that life like? What do you do?
And did you have any kind of rules you made for yourself in terms of personal life questions or, you know, professional versus Bob? I mean, you're clearly crossing a line, not, I don't think in a, you know, unprofessional way, but how did you think about that in terms of the questions you asked?
There were no rules, and never any rules agreed upon with the people either. I mean, the only rule really was, what am I interested in? You know, and I mean, to some degree, I think what I'm interested in was helpful in getting these interviews because, like, I am interested in the music first and foremost. I'm not super interested in, like, Bob Dylan's personal life, who's he dating, like who's he sleeping with. I sort of just don't really care. So like for instance, one of the people in this book herself, she was a tour manager. She herself wrote a book a while ago and she has this sort of salacious story about my one night stand with Bob Dylan, you know, and it was probably good for her book promo. I picked up the gossip rags and I could have asked her about that, but here, I want to know about what it's like being a tour manager on Rolling Thunder Review and putting those shows together and putting the tour together. So, you know, I think with probably a lot of people, once they saw that that was sort of just my area of interest, that helped them open up a little more.
That was one of my favorite chapters that I've read so far, her and it's Odell, right? And Jacques Levy's wife, I'm forgetting her first name.
Yeah, Claudia.
Claudia, those were great. I'm glad you included the non-musicians that are in there, Louis Kemp was good.
Yeah, that's one of the advantages of having done some of these in the newsletter is that people reach out to me. Claudia Levy emailed me because after one of them, I ran in my newsletter, Scarlett Rivera maybe. Claudia emailed me to say, hey, I was married to Jacques Levy. I feel like his story has never really been told. You know, Jacques himself passed a number of years ago, you know, and I was like, you want to talk to me? And she was like, yeah. So like, we got on the phone and talked for 2 hours, and I don't think she's ever been interviewed before, but it turns out not only was she married to the guy, but she was on the road the entire Rolling Thunder review. And I never would have thought, I didn't know she was, but you know, that's sort of one leads to the next.
That one's really great. And that is the other element of this, is I think individually, many of these people probably don't get asked a lot, and people don't think, hey, I need to go get the, you know, story from the guy who played the congas on Hurricane or whatever it was. And yet, A, they are, you know, there's mass there. They're interesting individually. And what you've done was just cool. It's just when you aggregate them, it's the perfect venue for them. It's probably, you know, most of them wouldn't have filled a, you know, 50-page chapter alone a book. But altogether, you get this beefy thing that tells something.
Yeah. Like I said in the intro, like I know a lot of people, because I would do this too. You look at the table of contents and like you want to jump to the people whose names you know, which I totally get. That's probably what I would do if I read the book. But I sort of say, the people whose names you don't know, who like you've literally never heard of, sometimes they have the best stories.
Yeah. And that ultimately what comes down to for me is this is all first person. And, you know, we spend a lot of time with theories that some guy made up in his head or fifth generation stories. And there's very few. I made a list last night, and there's about, you know, maybe six or seven kind of first person books that exist out there. And there's the interview compilations, but there's really a small number of books by or deep information by people who actually spent time with Bob. And so, and many of them aren't professional, frankly. They're tell-all, tattletale kind of stories that go on the other side. Here's our first clip. This is Stan Lynch from Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
I just thought every time he was in the room, there was this energy that was just, it was fun. Like I just went, that's what I kept, maybe I misinterpreted, you know, talk about a guy who can fucking read the room all wrong. That's me. But what I read was Bob was ready to have fun, have a good time, rock, play some music, don't stress, no posturing. Can we just make a joyful noise unto the Lord? You know, like that's what I felt whenever he was in the room. And every time he turned around, he would rock with me, man. That was my memory of like, you know, if I was catching a groove and the whole band was catching a groove, Bob did all the things that you want your front man to do, man. He was like, you know, hips are swaying, his shoulders are moving, he's looking at you and he's pointing. And I loved every inch of it.
So Stan's clip is representative of a lot. Actually, there's a bunch of quotes I've got later to talk to you about, of a lot of the reaction about the core experience of playing music with Bob, which I've found in what I've made it through is universally positive, is universally, you know, respectful, reverent,
you haven't
excited.
Gotten to the Duke Robillard chapter yet, clearly. The second to last.
I did. I read forward and backward because of the way you did the time sequence. So we'll get to that. But you know what I'm saying? These people are mostly, you know, some of the quotes you mentioned about people who say you can only learn from standing next to him, right? You summarize the experience of being on stage with Bob in terms of either what Stan Lynch said or other things you heard, right? That's the core of what no one's asked anyone before that you talked to a whole pile of people about.
It was striking to me when I sort of put these together in aggregate, just how many of these musicians compared playing with Dylan to jazz, even though on a literal genre level, Bob Dylan is not a jazz artist. Obviously, he's not Miles Davis. But, you know, I think so many of them found it refreshing and exciting to play, you know, even if the same song, you're going to play it a different way every night. Like Jim Keltner, I spoke to, and he was the drummer. I hadn't realized this, but on the big Simon and Garfunkel reunion tour, I don't know, 15 years ago. And he said he enjoyed it, but, you know, they're playing the hits. He's playing them exactly the same way every single night. And he compared that to playing with Dylan, where every single night you're on your toes. It's challenging you as a musician. It's making you better as a musician. And, you know, a lot of these people in the book are sort of the musicians, musician types, studio guys, touring guys, like, who really respond well to that environment. I mean, it can be challenging for others. You know, Marshall Crenshaw got fired before he even played a single show because he, as he says, his bass playing wasn't really up to the level of what Dylan was asking him to do. But for so many, that's sort of, you know, just life on stage rather than ever going through the motions, they found extremely valuable.
And what conclusion did you come to about, I know one thing you really dug into is how he communicates with them, which seems like, it almost seems like this dichotomy between he knows what he wants, but he won't tell you, but he gets you there somehow.
I think that's a good way to phrase it, because I was sort of surprised in two opposing directions. The one direction I was surprised in when I was doing these is just how extensive rehearsals are. Before every tour, even if it's a tour with the same musicians, he rehearses. He did a few days of rehearsals before the current tour in Europe, even though it's the same people he played with in Japan a couple months before that. So there's these extremely extensive rehearsals. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, what you spend all this time rehearsing may have little to nothing to do with what you actually play live, because he wants that sort of spontaneity. You know, there's another thing, Fred Tackett, who did guitar like during the gospel runs he was talking about, where during his era, Bob Dylan would assign him songs. Hey, teach the band Rainbow Connection. Teach the band Night Moves. Teach the band Sweet Caroline. That one we've heard eventually in the box set. And it wasn't that they were intending to play Night Moves on stage. It was that Fred's point was that he felt that Dylan didn't want to go over Like a Rolling Stone 100 times and have everyone sort of lock into their parts. He wanted the band to gel, people to really be vibing and feeling each other with these other songs they weren't intended to play, and then it would be fresher when they, you know, played It Ain't Me, Babe, or whatever, in concert.
How much did the frustration come through? I mean, we'll talk about the Duke Robillard issue later, but in anyone else, in terms of, maybe it's an issue of if you're good enough, you don't need to be told, and if you need to be told, you're not good enough and you shouldn't be there. But there is a whole lot of, you know, he didn't tell me. There's that Miles Davis quote that someone cites about, you know, don't tell me what, tell me how, or maybe I did that backwards. Did anyone else complain about it? Did anyone else find it struggling, or a lot of them found it invigorating?
Nothing was universal, but with a number of people, it sounded maybe invigorating with a side of frustrating. You know, 90% of the time it was invigorating, and 10% of the time they were like, Jesus Christ, this is getting annoying. I mean, even like Larry Campbell, who had a very successful and long tenure with Bob, you know, told me that he said during his time there was like a little space off stage that after the show they would go for 60 seconds. And if Bob had something to say to them, he'd say it. And, you know, that could be frustrating because Dylan would say one night, I want X. And then the next night, Larry or whoever would play X. And it turned out that wasn't what Dylan would want anymore. You know, and this is someone who had an extremely good and productive and long relationship with Dylan. So there, I think there is that, you know, inscrutable and mysterious is cool, but can also be frustrating if you are trying to give the boss what he wants, but you're not sure what it is.
At the recent Costello shows here, Tony Garnier played one night, and I got to talk to him with Scott Bunn from Recliner Notes actually after the show for a few minutes. And a version of this question we asked Tony, which was, you know, does Bob come back and say, hey, let's do this, or however it was phrased to Tony? And Tony just leaned back and said, I don't think he's ever said that to me. I mean, he was basically like laughing. He said, I don't think I've ever got a direct do this, you know, kind of thing. And yeah, that's the longest relationship ever, obviously. In terms of the day-to-day realities of working with him, like what conclusion did you come to, or any stories that you think of that just kind of the mundane about, you know, life on the road, going to the show, working? There's, you know, these people go through a lot. We think about this 90-minute period. They've got the rest of the day and their lives to lead.
You know, the book is sort of arranged roughly chronologically, and it seems like it's sort of his varied by era. I mean, you can think on the one hand, if I have a bunch of interviews with Rolling Thunder Review people, and, you know, they're on stage for 2 hours a night, and it seems like the other 22 hours, they're all hanging out with Dylan and going and filming zany scenes for Arnaldo and Claire, and it's just nothing but this big fun party, especially for the 75 portion. You know, so there's tons of hangout, and they all are, you know, friends, you know, with the guy. And then it varies, you know, and I would say, you know, more recently, Neverending Tour era, it's a little more, you know, standoffish isn't the word, but just professional. You do the job, you do the work. But one thing that sort of struck me is even in some of those periods, you know, like I talked to Dickie Betts, from the Allman Brothers, who was not ever a, you know, full-time band member, but has sat in a number of, I make sense of that. And he's talking about relatively, you know, within the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years of Bob inviting him backstage. And there's the story where Dickie Betts punched some guy and he landed on Bob's lap. And so now every time Bob sees him, Bob like feigns a punch at Dickie's face and says, "Hey, Dick, how's your right cross doing?" So like there's all these really personable moments of these people kind of throughout.
I didn't catch any of them that turned into close personal lifetime friends with Bob.
Not that they will share. Meaning, I'm sure that is true for most, for sure. But like there was an interesting moment at the end of my Regina McCrary interview. She was someone who was the background singer for all the gospel years, right? And that was essentially it for her professional relationship, with the exception of she and her sisters, who are a singing group, joined Dylan several times on stage in, I think, 2010s to sing Blowin' in the Wind. And so, you know, I was mostly asking about the 3 years they spent the road together, but I was like, hey, that's interesting how decades later this happened. And she basically indicated two things. One, that she and Dylan are still close, and the two, that was not something she wanted to talk about, which was fine, but sort of surprising. Again, as you say, I assume that people have their little chapters with him and then are sort of out of his life, but clearly not. Because I was like, so how did you and your sisters end up on stage like 30 years after you? And she's like, oh, I was just talking with Bob. And I said, hey, man, you still do Blowin' in the Wind? Because, you know, we sing that now. I was like, oh, you like still talk? She's like, yeah, we talk all the time. I was like, oh, well, not what I expected. but you know, that sort of thing, again, when it veers into personal life, people are, you know, I think fairly guarded.
There was this series of these kind of drop-bys. You know, there was the Noel Stuckey one, and there was a couple others that, and Claudia had mentioned that, you know, for years or some period after the working relationship we know about, Bob would drop by. And you know, the recent Lenoir interview, you know, he talked about, which, you know, now years later, that Bob called, wanted to play an album and came up. This kind of Bob calls out of the blue thing is something we do hear about. Conversely, right? He keeps them in mind. It might be a decade, it might be two decades, and he calls and shows up.
Yeah, my favorite story of that was, I think, in the Harvey Brooks chapter. I mean, Harvey is a guy who played bass during some of the early Electric stuff. I was 61, some shows, and then on New Morning. And then that was about it, you know. And I should say, because this is important to the story, they hung out together in Woodstock a lot in that late 60s, early 70s period. But, you know, 71 comes and goes, and you know, they go their separate ways. In the 80s, so we're talking 10 to 15 years later, Harvey is sitting at home with his family, and a black car pulls up, and at his house, and who should step out of the car but Bob Dylan, who he hasn't spoken to in ages. But he still lived in the same place. Dylan just decided to drop by, and I guess he was in the area, see if Harvey was around. And it ended up, you know, Harvey ended up playing him some albums he liked, and Dylan took a few songs. This is, I think, late 80s, early 90s, because Dylan took a few songs from those albums, Arthur McBride and one other, ended up recording them within a year or so. And this is just this random drop-by. And if Harvey wasn't home, I suspect he never would have known about it, you know? But he was home, and Bob pulls up in his car and gets out and says, hey, you want to listen to some music?
Next, we have a clip. This is Fred Tackett, who played with Dylan in the Born Again years.
My wife called me up at a session and said, hey, we got a call from Bob Dylan's office wanting you to come down and jam with him. You know, so it was great, man. And we did that for about 3 weeks. I was driving over every day in Santa Monica and just, you know, going over mostly his brand new song. We just did that every day. And I remember I was driving down the road and I thought, wow, man, like 3 weeks. I wonder when, you know, we're going to like get to to the end of this. And then I said,
is it clear that this is like an audition or that there's a tour?
No, it's just like, can you come down and jam with it? I'm like, sure, I want to come down and jam with you. And I just kept thinking, well, fuck, you know, what is the point of all it? And I knew they were going to go out and do a gig. You know, I knew they were going out on tour, you know, because Spooner Oldham, all the band was there. And but nobody was really saying much about it. And I mean, I was like starting to get a little frustrated. And then I told myself on the way down there, I was going, you know, there's 50,000 guitar players. They would love to go spend 3 weeks jamming with Bob Dylan and Jim Keltner. You know, what are you griping about?
The other recurring theme or vignette that comes up in the book is Bob rehearsing, pulling people in, trying people out. They don't know why, what it's for. Sometimes they turn into something, sometimes they don't. There's other people, you know, who don't make it as far as they do. And then they get a call. Any other interesting stories that come to mind about coming into Bob's orbit and being asked to join?
One thing that comes up a lot in these stories is people say, I didn't know when I was hired, because I'll ask like, so like, how did you get officially? And they're like, I was never officially anything. Like, I just jammed with him for a few weeks. And, you know, his manager said, all right, we're going to France next week. Your plane ticket. I mean, the most dramatic one probably is this guy, Tony Marsico, member of the Plugs, who for Dylan fans, you know, they're best known as having backed Dylan up on that Letterman performance in 84, that great 3-song set. What I hadn't known before talking to Tony was that those 3 songs were the product of months of rehearsal. But it wasn't that we're rehearsing for Letterman. It was just that Bob Dylan was hanging out in California, wanted to jam with some young guys. Someone turned him on to the Plugs, this sort of LA punk band. They went to his house every day for literally several months, just jamming and playing. And at some point, there was some sort of show in Hawaii that was discussed, and that never happened. There was some sort of tour that was mentioned and disappeared. And then one day, you know, Bob was like, all right, hey, there's some new late night show with David Letterman going to play next week. You guys want to come do that? And so publicly to us, that's it for Dylan and the Plugs, these 3 songs on this one TV show. But it was really that they had spent all this time, again, as you say, rehearsing is almost too grand a word for it. They were just jamming. They were like hanging out and playing music. And that's an extreme example, but that sort of thing comes up a lot.
Do you draw any conclusions from this process? This kind of, you know, come by, drop by, I'll try a few people, come, go. I don't know. It's very interesting about how he's kind of a bit happenstance. Like, you know, the guy's home, the guy's not home, the guy's, you know, Alan Pasqua's story about, you know, come tomorrow. It's like, I don't want to come tomorrow. And then I better come tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a number like that where it's like, if you get the call, you better show up when they say, otherwise it's just, he's going to move on to someone else. Yeah. It's like, I don't know. He doesn't want commitment or anything. I mean, another interesting thing I heard several times was that even for band members who were there for years, it was always like one tour to the next. A tour would end, and they'd be like, well, maybe I'll get a call in a month, or maybe I'll never hear from him again. You know, that happened pretty often. And, you know, then sort of people can come and go more easily. But even the people who stick around, it's not like, all right, you are in my band in sort of a formal, official way. It's like, all right, we're going to do a run of dates. You know, we're going to do a month. Not come along for the month. And then the month can, one by one tour by one tour, turn into, you know, 5 or 6.
And is there any distaste that you get from that, or do you think over time they've all come to accept it? You know, it's unusual.
The distaste related to that, I feel like I heard, was not so much about the tour by tour, but just how many days of the year you end up on the road. I mean, that's why Larry Campbell left. That's why a number of people have left. It's just sort of this, what's that quote, Last Waltz, sustainable lifestyle. Obviously, it is sustainable because Dylan does it, but for other people, not named Tony Garnier or Donnie Herron, you know, you can only go through so long of spending 9 months on the road every year. So that's why I heard more distaste with that, but no, I didn't hear as much with the, you know, not having a year.
And how did you feel like people, they obviously look back on it fondly and it's an amazing experience, but it also does strike me that when you leave the show, you know, none of the none of the glow comes with you. It all stays with Bob. So they have to kind of go back to a different life, which is, you know, fine. They're all successful people and they all do interesting things. But that change, that distance and the process of leaving and the result of leaving.
No, I would say there's some glow does go with them in the sense of both professionally, like a lot of these people have much bigger profiles and are very well aware of that because of their time with Dylan. And also in terms of the what they learned, what they took away with, you know, I remember exactly what it is, but there's that quote from Ben Montage that I closed the intro, which is basically you can only learn by playing with this person and then, you know, take it away and you pass it on to other people. So I think that is what they take with them, whether they were there for months or years.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I just mean, you know, from in terms of the size of places they play. I mean, even we see in the world today, you know, sidemen of famous bands who do side projects, you know, play a tenth of the seats, sort of halls.
Yeah, I think, and maybe this is to some degree how Dylan chooses them. Maybe the reason that's not stronger than it is that a lot of these people sort of want to be in the background. You know, if you looked at the number at the 48 people in my book, the number of people in this who have recorded records under their own names is relatively small. These are people who don't want to be the front man, don't want to be playing the arena themselves, but want to be in the studio or putting bass on. You know, you think of someone like Jim Keltner. He's been played with every single household name you can think of, but there's no Jim Keltner record. He's not itching to do a bunch of solo projects, but boy, the labels just won't let me, you know, as far as I can tell. So I think that probably helps. And yeah, probably the fact that some of these people do jump from Dylan to, like, you know, Luther Ricks left to go play with Leonard Cohen and Charlie Sexton's playing with Elvis Costello now, you know, so a lot of them do land on their feet with someone else, right?
Yeah, and there's that breakdown between the guys who are really studio guys and the guys who are road guys. And it seems like Dylan doesn't care what you are. He'll pull you either way, because there's a number of those stories where the studio guys got pulled right out by Dylan.
Yeah, there's a couple people in the book who said no when he asked him to go on the road specifically because they were really studio guys. I mean, that's sort of one thing Duke Robillard said, is that he kept getting asked to play with Dylan. He kept saying no because it was related to touring. Then he got asked to play with Dylan in a studio for Time Out of Mind. Then he was like, oh yeah, hell yeah, I'll do that, you know, because that's sort of what I want to be doing, but not.
Yeah, so let's talk about Duke. So he tells some stories, you know, obviously there's a little bit of the things we've heard about that we didn't know, but the end of that relationship, at least the touring side. I saw three of Duke's shows, I think. I was lucky enough.
Did you really? There weren't that many. That must be like, you know, a third.
Yeah, it was that little northeast Rhode Island, and I don't know where, but anyway, why don't you share a little bit of that, you know, of both the story he told you and the sense you got from him about it.
Yeah, so Duke is like a number of people in this book that has come in and out several times. Like I said, he played on Time Out of Mind, and nothing but good things to say about, you know, about working with Dylan for that. It's a big success. So then he leaves. 97, he's done. What is that? 16 years later, 2013, he joins Dylan's band on the road. And, you know, sort of the quick version of the story is it goes well until it doesn't. In Duke's telling, it's about a month where he felt like going well. He was, you know, learning how it went, and Dylan seemed, as far as he could, happy. And then all of a sudden, Dylan was not. And this was fairly public because Dylan was like glaring at him, yelling at him on stage. And it turns out backstage too. And it just breaks down horribly in this giant fight on Dylan's tour bus. And, you know, Duke says he quit. Maybe he did, but it might be because Dylan forced him to quit, you know, that sort of thing. And it then, you know, in terms of the actual chronology, it became fairly public in sort of the super fan communities, the forums, because Duke posted various cryptic things on Facebook, like he was selling all his Dylan records. I think that was how people learned he wasn't in the band anymore, because he said he was selling all his Bob Dylan records, which was true. He did sell all his Bob Dylan records. He was extremely pissed and bitter about the whole thing at the time. But now we're talking 10 years later, and, you know, he seems like he sort of has a better perspective on it, where he's like, look, of the whatever it is, 2 months I spent with Dylan, a month and a half of them I felt were really good. And it broke down horribly and publicly, but it was, you know, over the course of like four shows, maybe a week's time, and then it was over. So I think he's sort of gotten a lot, a lot of perspective on it. And yeah, because he's one of those where, like, I knew going in, I got to ask about it, but it was like a little touchy. I mean, sure, we can talk about Time Out of Mind and how good that was and stuff, but like, come on, we got to talk about how Bob was yelling about you on stage. And so I was like a little worried he wouldn't want to go there. But yeah, he was happy to talk about it and, you know, what it felt like to be publicly scolded by Dylan, which, spoiler alert, not good. And just, you know, the sort of behind the scenes stuff that led to this total communication breakdown.
I definitely saw him in the honeymoon phase because not only was Duke great and distinctive for the run of guitarists in that period for Bob, I thought, but Bob seemed super happy with him on stage, like, I mean, visibly, you know, loving what he was playing. And that ending story was great. I thought the other interesting thing was Duke telling you that he expected to finish his career with Bob. So he didn't have the memo that it was tour to tour to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, that was the saddest part, just because he had said one of the reasons he had never joined, he'd been asked to tour with Bob over and over again for like 20 years, you know, like every 3 or 4 years, there would be a call. And, you know, he is one person who records with his own band. He has his own name. It's like, I didn't want to, you know, I got guys on salaries. I don't want to like fire my band, you know, just now I'm Bob Dylan's guitarist. So it took a lot for him to do that. And he did. He like let his band go and said, all right, now for the remainder of my career, you know, I'm going to be Bob Dylan's guitarist. And yeah, it lasted like a month and a half, which I think explains why in the immediate aftermath he was bitter about it.
Time for another clip. Here we have Larry Campbell, who first played with Bob in 1997.
Yeah, man, that was surreal. That I remember really well. Yeah, with this 400,000 people out there, we're on this stage. Pope's been up there all day long doing his thing, and with all these international acts performing, you know, acrobats and magicians I didn't even get to see most of it, but and then we get up there to play a few songs, and so we're facing the audience, and off on stage left is the Pope's throne, and he's sitting there, you know, and he's got his chin in his hand, and I think he must have been exhausted at the time. And so we play a couple of tunes, and there's TV cameras, and I'm on stage right, and Bob's doing, I forget what song we're doing, maybe it was Knocking on Heaven's Door or something like that. But the TV director with his headphones on, you know, I'm standing there playing, he comes walking up to me, he says, he's got to go meet the Pope. He's a guy going to meet a Pope. He's looking at his watch and he's looking at me like I'm supposed to do something about this, you know. And typical Italian fashion, man. And he's hitting his head. He's looking at his watch. He's a guy going to meet the Pope. And I'm trying to play this song, you know. So we get the song ends, and I walked over to Bob and I said, hey, Bob, this guy's telling me you got to go meet the Pope. And Bob looks around like what? And then the TV director looks at him and just, you know, with hand signals, you know, he shrugs his shoulders and he points to the Pope. So Bob hands his guitar to somebody and goes over and shakes the Pope's hand. The Pope gives him a rosary or something. And he comes back and we play one more tune and then that's over. And that was an experience I never expected to have. And it was just surreal. That's all I can say.
In your earlier interviews, and I've heard before you talking to folks, you often asked about famous shows. You've taken a lot of people through a lot of the cooler shows in Dylan's career where they've been a part of. What cool shows inspired good stories, or you thought were fun tidbits that you got?
A lot. I mean, that's one of the tricks I've learned interviewing these people is that the more specifics you bring, the more specifics you get back. You can just talk about general stuff about playing with Dylan all day long, and I like that. But talking about, you know, getting into like the super fan nitty gritty is fascinating. Like, for instance, I talked with Christopher Parker, who is the first drummer of the Neverending Tour. He was there from 88, 92. And one show that, again, this is like a super fan thing, but Toad's Place, you know, this famous show, it's like 4 hours long, and Dylan's playing Dancing in the Dark and all these songs he basically like barely even knows, and it's extremely rough. And like, and hearing Chris tell the story was fascinating, because it's they get set up in this Toad's Place, which is this tiny little club in New Haven, for what, as far as Christopher Parker knows, is a private rehearsal. You know, a lot of times Dylan will rehearse the band on a stage with no audience somewhere. They don't see fairly often. And then all of a sudden, like the first person comes in, and Chris is like, oh, I guess that's like a friend of the manager's. And another person, all of a sudden he realizes they're doing this rehearsal in front of a crowd. Like, that's like super nerdy, super fan stuff. But I find that so fascinating that something like that, that is a fairly famous, bordering on infamous show in Dylan history, the band themselves didn't even realize it was a concert. All of a sudden there's an audience in front of them.
In terms of other famous shows, you know, these are guys playing dozens or hundreds of shows, and some shows stand out to us because, you know, that in that case it was a venue and a set list issue. Other ones, you know, the Pope is there, and other ones it just, the tape got famous. Is what you've learned that they stand out for them, or to them it was, you know, tonight's Cleveland, tomorrow's Toledo? I don't know the difference.
It can go either way. I mean, as you say, sometimes it's just the tape got, you know, maybe there was a soundboard, so the tape's really good, and we all had the bootleg back in the day. But they're like, I don't know, that was like one show of 30 we played that month. I don't remember that show. So sometimes you'll get, you know, interesting stories about shows you never would have asked about. Like they're like, you know, another story like from Ben Montench is him talking about this show where right as they were about to go on stage, Dylan turns to him and says, so what song do you want to play? And Ben Mott's like, and he says, tomorrow is a long time, which they had never played or even rehearsed. And, you know, you can hear that on the tape. It's not like a super, super famous moment or tape or anything, but that like really stood out to him because, like, you know, what we were talking about, a sort of spontaneity, that was one of the moments that stuck with him on what was otherwise a fairly random, you know, random sort of show. It's not like a, you know, something, a specific show or a specific song performance I would have thought to ask about. But I didn't. Then again, I didn't know the backstory.
Yeah, I think a lot of those cases where people talk to Bob about one of his songs, where you kind of get a glimpse of his relationship to it, or his relationship to other folks' relationship to it. Who is the guy who said he didn't know Positively 4th Street, but he'd learn it? Bob thought that was funny.
I think that was Pasqua, maybe. Yeah, or like speaking of Chris Parker, the drummer again. At one point, he asked Bob something like, "So, like, what sort of arrangement do you want me to play on this song?" And Bob said, I'm just a fucking poet. Which I thought was a funny line, and also a way to not answer the question. And Bob's like, I'm not going to tell you what drum arrangement to play. Get out of here.
The first set of highlights I made as I went through the book were, you know, there's a lot of these kind of, you know, insider stories and revealing anecdotes, but there's also a lot of kind of great tidbits that come dripping out along the way. So I've got a pretty long list here. Noel Stuckey has unused original Dylan lyrics, and you remind him of them, and he decides he should go look in the archives for them.
Yeah, that was funny, right?
Yeah. Playing All My Tomorrows for Lauren Bacall on a hotel piano. So these are all things that someone has to track down. This is the assignment, I think. The Tracks of My Tears playing with Michael Bloomfield and Goldberg.
That was one of those where, you know, as he was talking, I was Googling like, wait, is this out there? Which happens sometimes. Sometimes it is, and often it's not. But there's tons of things where I'm like looking for, you know, or speaking of Goldberg, there's that, they do that, was it the Alan Toussaint thing that he's raving about, the
right,
song of the 80s that he thought was fantastic. And I think Dylan coughed on it or something. He didn't like it, but he was like, why wasn't this on the Springtime in New York box?
Oh, I don't know if I caught that, but also mentioning Toussaint, he talked about the Rolling Thunder crew going to a recording studio in New Orleans.
Yeah, before, because that's again one of those things where I asked about a specific thing I did know about, which was they had had this party at Bobby Charles's place, you know, this legendary swamp rock musician. But yeah, Gary Burke was like, yeah, but before that, we went to Toussaint's studio and we did some recordings, and he was excited because he was playing on the Meters dude's drums. And so, you know, as a drummer, I was really excited about that. Yeah. I didn't know that it even happened. And now I certainly want to hear the recordings. Who knows what happened?
Well, maybe we need to take this list down to our friends in Tulsa and see what what's on record. Richard Alderson saying he's got a better version of the Gaslight Master Tape.
Yeah, he was sort of pissed at whoever it was, Sony or whatnot. He's like, they released this and they just like, you know, basically, which as we've learned is done fairly often, they like download a bootleg off the internet and then release it rather than going to the original tapes. He's like, no one asked me.
Right, but he said his are markedly better. It's
yeah,
kind of
yeah.
enticing.
Because the ones they, yeah. Yeah, he was saying the ones that they released were like, I mean, it was his tapes, but, you know, second or third generation, right. You know, had been through a few tapings over or whatever you call it.
So I know these are lightly edited. Is the part where you said, can I have a copy, what you took out of the...
No, I usually don't ask that. Although some people have sent me, I mean, not like amazing unheard Dylan recordings, but some people have been really generous, like Gary Burke, the percussionist, after we hung up. He's like, hey, I'll send you some. And he sent me this like original, his own Rolling Thunder itinerary. It's like pages and pages of like typewriter thing of like where we're staying and what time the band's call is and stuff about sound checks. And like, so I have gotten some sort of ephemera like that from these people, which is always a nice bonus.
So Keltner told you he's got a Seattle 1980s board tape. I know we have Seattle 80. I don't know if we've got a board tape from it.
But. Yeah. I mean, unless I'm mixing him up with someone else, but I think it was him basically said they sort of asked for it. They like called up the Dylan office and were like, hey, I want to hear. I don't remember what specifically, but there was someone specific he wanted to hear. And yeah, they just sent him a tape. It was either him or someone else.
Ronnie Blakely has the Hurricane lyric sheet, if not, probably not original manuscript, but what she was rolling through with Bob and throwing on the floor as they went.
Yeah, every page everyone just tossing on the floor.
I'm glad they all get souvenirs. Did you go find this? The other thing, Pasqua, I thought was also one of my favorite interviews in the book. This show he talked about in Germany where people were throwing paintballs or whatever at the band and they had to leave for a half hour. Is that a circular
yeah,
recording?
Yeah, you can. It is. As I recall, it's been a couple of years. I don't recall the recording. You know, they edited out the part where the band wasn't on stage. So I don't remember you noticing anything in the recording, but I did look up some contemporary press coverage of that. And as I recall, it was sort of an underwhelming answer. It had something to do with some political protest that really didn't have much to do with Dylan at all. It just sort of was spillover from something that was happening in the city that day or whatever. But yeah, it's a show. You can look it up. And it was written about the time that people were hurling like bottles and pieces of paint or something at the stage. And they had to go retreat until and Pasqua thought they were going home. And then so he changed out of his stage clothes and then Bob comes and says, what are you doing? Squaw says, well, we're leaving, aren't we? And he says, no, once these idiots settle down, we're going back out there. And you know, again, that's one of these moments I never would have, that's not a show I would have known to ask about. But for Alan, that was a big sort of a big moment for him because he was like, that's how you think that's what a professional does. You play the show.
I thought that was another recurring theme that came up, which is, and there's other people I've talked to where this has come up, that you know, the soy bomb incident, right? We all, the most unflinching moment of weirdness maybe in all of Bob's history, but time and time again, Bob is the mature, experienced, wise, knows how to handle things person, and these situations come up. And there's a lot of cases in the book where he gives these people kind of fatherly or professional advice or sort of shows that. And the other thing that is in the same vein that came up is everybody said, even when he was personally unhappy or things were going on the tour, he didn't bring it on stage, that on stage he was, you know, largely always there.
Yeah. I mean, I remember Rob Stoner, who was on both of the Rolling Thunder reviews. You know, I asked him about the difference between 75 and 76. And he said the difference, the massive difference off stage, like 75, everyone's hanging out, having fun. 76, you know, no one sees Bob except on stage practically because he's going through all sorts of personal life stuff. But musically, like he's still on every night. You know, you can see what he's got, you know, what he's dealing with maybe off stage in terms of whether he's hanging out or not. But on stage, he's always there.
I also love that the story about the 2-hour rehearsal for the Fort Collins show to get the stops and starts right in.
I think it was
Tangled.
That was Gary Burke again, maybe. Yeah, just was saying they were trying to do Tangled Up in Blue and Howie Wyeth did use. The sort of backstory is there is Howie Wyeth, the usual drummer, was under the weather, so it wasn't clear that he was going to make the show. And so it was partly to sort of get Gary to learn how to play the show and play the song. And again, I didn't realize that because, you know, it's definitely, you know, the video is only a handful of songs, but Howie Wyeth is not half of that most famous show, and then he sort of shows up partway through. I guess he's feeling
it. It's also interesting because that's one of the more dramatic rearrangements of a song, right? And we do have video of it. And all of a sudden to find out, hey, this wasn't spontaneous, or Bob just decided to wind him up and wind him down, you know, by tilting the neck of his guitar, but they went somewhere in a room for 2 hours and really worked on it. It's kind of nice when some of the mystery gets revealed, I think, a little bit.
Yeah. You know, one of the big surprises across all these is, as I might have said before, just how extensive the rehearsals are. You know, and again, it's not, Bob does not ever, across decades, come in with chord charts and he's handing out, here's your part on the drums. And, you know, never how it happens. They just get in a room, Bob says next to nothing, and they start playing. And then, you know, they emerge at 1 day, 2 days, a week later with new arrangements on these songs. So even though they're not dictated, they are heavily worked.
Now here's a clip from Christopher Parker, who joined Bob for the first show of the Neverending Tour and stayed a few years.
So there were explorations by everybody, you know, should I play guitar? Should I play brushes? Should I play accordion? GE often played acoustic or his Telecaster, and Bob sometimes played, you know, acoustic with harmonica around his neck, you know, traditional Bob style, or he played Stratocaster. So the band could be really, really rocky, you know, electric rocky, or it could be very intimate and folky, and beyond that, even, you know, jazzy. Tunes would kind of float like a Bill Evans Trio record, or a lot of music. And I had the gall at one point to say, well, what do you want me to play on this then? And Bob said, quote, I'm just a fucking poet.
So back to my list of revelations in the book, or sort of cool tidbits for the hardcore. Alan Pasqua identifying the piano separation on Murder Most Foul, Benmont on the left, him on the right, and Fiona in the middle. Good listening.
Yeah,
tip.
As soon as I heard that, I went, you know, as soon as we hung up, I put on my headphones. And yeah, sure enough, but you wouldn't have picked that out without him calling.
And then one I'm going to scour eBay for the rest of my life for is the I Hate Jock Levy t-shirt that someone printed up.
I have literally searched eBay for that. Because it wasn't just a one-off. I mean, they printed them up for a bunch of people from the sound of it. So you'd think one would pop up occasionally. I haven't seen any.
So we kind of touched on this, but I made a list as I went through of what I was calling anti-advice. I made a whole list of recurring themes in the book. One was that Bob's a little strange. Two is that, you know, there's wisdom and this deep, thoughtful approach. Another is, which I've noticed for years, you know, even in the last 20, 30 years seeing him, of how late this idea of people laser locked on him, that the way they get through shows. It's not that unusual for musicians, but it seems like with Bob, it's kind of 10x. But so many people mention that to you, that they have to stare at everything. And was it Regina who was telling you about looking at his feet? And you were like, why are you looking at his feet?
Yeah, for the rhythm. Yeah, and of course, Bob being Bob, he screws with people. I don't remember who it was, but someone was telling me that, like, they saw him literally turning the guitar sort of away so that people couldn't see what it was like. I think maybe it was Ray Benson, like a guest, so they couldn't, like, see what chords he was playing because he wanted them to, you know, listen. So they're laser locked visually, but also just having to laser lock and listen to what he's doing.
So then one I put on my list I called anti-advice, and this is sort of a list of this kind of credo that seems to be a consistency with Bob. So he told Keltner, don't settle on one thing, you know, in terms of playing, like don't find a good way, but keep playing it differently. He told Freddie Carrilla not to learn the songs. That seems like an anti-advice poster. There's that discussion with Keltner about the bits versus overall on Time Out of Mind, which I thought was super revealing about how Bob, you know, thinks about it, meaning there's cool things going on, but that's, you got to think about that differently than the overall, you know, overall effect. Burke told you something about, you know, he was more in the moment than most musicians in terms of just noticing that Bob was again, going with the flow as opposed to trying to bring the script to the situation. And his other quote is about spontaneity, electricity, and living on the edge. So I don't know, in aggregate, what did you learn about Bob's approach to musicianship and to playing live?
Yeah, I like the term anti-advice. I mean, and another sort of variation on that is the sort of, I don't know what phrasing would be, but like people take these lessons from things that Bob has done or examples Bob has set without him explicitly telling them, which I mean sort of relates to how they do the musicianship. You know, like Bob will kind of like the "I'm just a fucking poet" line, which is like a silly joke, but the lesson he took from it was like, don't just, here's your part and you're going to play that part every single night because I want like a Rolling Stone to sound the same every night so people can sing along. You know, Bob will say these things, sometimes cryptic, that people sort of will just take lessons from that sometimes just apply to Bob Dylan, but sometimes they say they sort of take it with them to their other gigs. And it does often involve some of the things just listed, like spontaneity, not getting a part down explicitly, like just living in the moment, following the music where it takes you.
One more clip. This is Billy Cross, who played on the Street Legal tour.
I think my favorite song is one I didn't play on. It was the way they did "Tangled Up in Blue." I thought that was unbelievable. I had goosebumps every time he did it. It was just Bob and Steve and Alan, and it was remarkable. It was. He always sounds best when there is the least amount of music behind him in some ways, because he has so much power. He's such an unbelievably great singer that I don't need a lot to listen to Bob. You know, it's hearing him by himself sometimes is like even more powerful than hearing him with a band.
Well, that's an interesting aspect of this, because Bob, other than the very beginning of his career, is going out with people who generally know him well, revere him, knew these songs, again, as we've talked about, not all of them, but so they get to play, you know, they're coming into their childhood or their teenage, you know, musical fantasy. What stories did you hear about getting to play or interact on songs that they had a personal history with in a situation that became memorable that they're now a part of?
Yeah, there were a lot of those. Like for instance, one is Benmont. And this is, you know, the Heartbreakers tour, especially the first one, was a little more structured than I think most of these tours. And so he just, like, you know, he's someone who had studied the Al Cooper part on Like a Rolling Stone. And so he sort of said, essentially, you know, on the other songs, I tried to like make my own and do different things. But I was like, if I'm playing Like a Rolling Stone, like I'm just trying to do that Al Cooper part. What a thrill that is. Or like there's that another Heartbreaker, Stan Lynch. He has that story of, you know, he's one of my favorite interviews, and he has the story of, like, you know, Dylan plays Blowing in the Wind a lot, and it's a solo acoustic thing, so the drummer has no reason to be there, so he usually goes off stage and has a smoke or, you know, whatever, just checks his watch when it's time to go back on. One night he stays on stage and he just watches, just sitting at the drum kit, watches Bob Dylan do Blowing in the Wind, and he says, you know, it's like one of the greatest songs ever. And it's just like he starts crying just sitting there because he's so moved and so overwhelmed with emotion watching the man himself do this song, you know, 10 feet behind him. And so, yeah, a lot of these musicians, you know, for all the sort of stress and just logistics and everything about being on the road that much, they all seem to have these stories about these moments that just sort of, when it struck them, who they're playing with and what the catalog they're playing is.
In terms of learning about Bob, let's do both sides, the musician and the person. What's the sum of it for you, or what did you get out of it other than a great book?
All right, well, I'll take personal first and then talk about musical. Personal, what struck me talking to all these people is, to put it bluntly, it's encouraging that Bob Dylan is not an asshole. As a fan, you know, he's so inscrutable. He's not, you know, friendly or Lord knows approachable, you know. So, like, I was like, you know, and again, you hear these sort of rumored stories of someone someone told someone that backstage you're not allowed to look him in the eye, right? That's something that comes up. And so it was extremely encouraging that people generally had very good things to say about their offstage interactions, that he was, you know, approachable and nice and friendly. And there's all these stories of doing favors for people he didn't have to do. He really processed this thing about Bob, you know, helping his wife or about to be wife fly around with them just to, you know, save some money and keep the couple together. So that was on the personal level sort of encouraging, because again, it's so, his world is so mysterious that you just don't know. And then on the musical level, I mean, to some degree, we do know more about that because we have seen the shows and heard the tapes and everything. But just how much work it takes to be that spontaneous is sort of fascinating. It's so free and it's so ever-changing, and every night is different than the last. And that is no accident. And that is not them just getting out there and winging it every night. That is picking the right musicians, making sure they gel, all this rehearsal and work, all this work to make it seem not like work, you know, all this work to not get people to learn their parts, all this work to keep people open and alive and in the moment. You know, like Chris Parker has this, one of the songs that stuck out to him was Knocking on Heaven's Door, which is not a song he would typically play on. But one night he said he went back on, and like near the end, he's just standing off the side of the stage listening. Near the end, he's like, this is really building. This could use a big sort of drum fill at the end. So, you know, 60 seconds before the song ends, he goes on and he does this big drum fill. And he says, Bob looks at him and gives him a big smile. And he felt really good about that. And he says, but I didn't do it the next night, because I knew if I did it the next night, Bob would be pissed. That's like a one night only sort of thing. So it takes a lot of work to get that level of comfort with all these musicians and that level of spontaneity. But of course, as we all know, it pays off the tapes and shows.
You know, what we kind of learned from Tulsa that we didn't know, you know, the myth is Bob walks in and jets off a song in 5 minutes. And now we know there's, you know, 400 pages of Joker Man and whatever it is on everything. So he worked unbelievably hard on everything behind the scenes. And you're able to kind of tell the musical side of that, which is really interesting, that the same thing was true. And I think you put that well, that spontaneity is hard, you know? So the idea of saying we're going to rehearse for 2 weeks on a bunch of tracks we're not going to play to congeal in a way that we have enough relationship to do something in a moment when it appears is the hard way to do it, right? It's probably easier to learn the song, but that's not what he wanted. And he's willing to put the time in. The earlier point about them rehearsing before every tour, I've always thought is both interesting and, you know, very commendable, that, you know, Bob could phone it in 100 ways.
Even in recent years, I mean, the Rough and Rowdy Ways, with the exception of the occasional Dead cover, has basically been the exact same songs for going on 2 years now, with one exception, the exact same musicians. Theoretically, he doesn't need to rehearse When I Paint My Masterpiece anymore. He's played it a gajillion times over the past 2 years, but before every tour, they get together for a few days. And as I say, it comes across because the arrangements change, and the arrangements, I might've thought, just sort of evolve on stage or something. No, they work on a new arrangement. And so when this tour, My Own Version of You, sounded totally different than it did in Japan, that's just not some random accident that the drummer played too fast one night. It's like they worked on it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're so dramatically different. I mean, you know, as I've said before, I'm not the one who can always notice musical subtlety sometimes. And I love when it's pointed out by people who can, but a lot of these songs, you know, the Rough and Rowdy Ways songs, more than anything, have really evolved from the album to the first tour to the third tour. And it's obvious it's work. So anyway, it's good to see the credit and the awareness of that coming out. And then, you know, to your first point, I've always thought that, do we have a million Bob Dylan stories? We probably do at this point. And there's some kind of jerk stories, but there's way more people consistently who work with him, who revere him and say very positive things about it. And it is nice to see story after story in this book where people say nice things and just clearly have a really warm feeling about him from both the professional and the personal experience. And, all right, Ray. Well, I'm waiting for the movie. I want you to know that mostly as I've read this thing, I thought, okay, we got to call these people in, you know, with the quality of the you know, with Jeff Rosen off stage prompting them, and two nice mm-hmm. cameras and nice lighting and a faded brown background, and turn this into a movie, because these people have great stories, and you got them out of them.
Yeah, well, it was a pleasure to do. And like I said, I tried to get myself out of the book as much as possible. I just want people to be able to hear the stories, you know, as directly from them.
All right. Well, thanks for doing it. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks for listening. This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network. Visit us at fmpods.com.